Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. In the world outside of Hollywood, directors may be one of the most misunderstood professions. Are they the authors of their own films? Are they simply part of the studio machinery, moving cast and crew through their paces? Are they collaborative with the writer or writers of the film? Do they work with the director of photography or leave these experts to do their own magic? One of the most misunderstood and undervalued directors was George Cukor, who had a long career in Hollywood and directed such films as The Philadelphia Story, Gaslight, Adam's Rib, Born Yesterday, and A Star is Born. My guest today examines the importance of George Cukor. He is Joseph McBride. He's author of George Cukor's People, Acting for a Master Director. It's published by Columbia University Press, and it's available on Amazon, first the ebook, and then, of course, then the print book. Joe, welcome to the show.
Great to see you, Ira. It's good to be back with you.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you on. Why did you decide to write about George Cukor?
Well, I've been writing about him for about 50 years, actually, more than 50 years off and on. I've done articles about him. I think it's because it's a challenge. I usually write books because I want to rectify some injustice that's been done, people who are overlooked or misunderstood. And he is, he's been honored a lot, and everybody has some favorite Cukor films. You mentioned some of the great ones. He had such a wide range of work, but what he did has never been analyzed properly, in my opinion. And I wasn't doing it, when I was writing about him before, I felt I hadn't quite captured what he does, because he worked through his actors. He was a self-effacing kind of director who believed in expressing himself through the people in the films. And as Katharine Hepburn said, she was in 10 of his films, let me get the exact quote. She said, you never had to put a label on the bottle because it was unmistakable. All the people in your pictures are as goddamn good as they can possibly be, and that's your stamp. So he was self-effacing to the extent that he wasn't showing off his virtuosity with the camera or other things that some directors do. But he used the camera very eloquently, and he was particularly good at very long takes, very complex choreography. But it's not the kind of thing that calls attention to itself. But if you're a film aficionado, you notice that, oh my gosh, the camera's been moving around for 5 or 6 minutes with Katharine Hepburn and Laurence Olivier and Love Among the Ruins. He told me actors like that can sustain scenes because they come from the theater. And the other thing about Cukor was he was came from the theater, and he usually adapted plays, and he didn't write his own scripts. He influenced the scripts, but he said he believed in fidelity to the text. And that's not something that most directors will say. And I'm a member of the Writers Guild of America. And around 1980, we gave Cukor an award for his respect for writers, which I believe is unprecedented. The Writers Guild giving a director an award. And I remember how happy he was to get that. He treated writers really well. And he felt that he was his job was to find a good work to adapt and have good screenwriters work on it. He had certain people he worked with over and over again, like Donald Ogden Stewart and Zoe Akins and Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin, and then get the best actors and express himself through them. So his personality was kind of elusive. And, it gets to the heart of what does a director actually do? And there's a confusion in America. It's a big subject, but people think that somebody's not an auteur unless he writes his own scripts. And that's a fallacy, actually, because the French devised what they called the Politique des Auteurs to account for directors like Cukor who didn't write their own scripts. In other words, what does the director do? And Truffaut and other people, François Truffaut, when he was a critic, he said the problem with Cukor is out of every five films he makes is one masterpiece, three very good films, and one good film. But he said he's not the kind of director you write about. He's the kind of director you discuss with your friends at the cafe or in the street after you see the film. So I took it as a big challenge. Let's do justice to what this man actually did. And I think I solved the problem by writing I write about 65 essayistic portraits of performances in his work, a very fine detail, and I tried to analyze what he did with the actor to make these performances work. And through these people in the films, I analyze, okay, what is the film doing and saying? So that's my method in this book, and I think it worked. It's an experiment in film criticism.
Well, you mentioned the award from the Writers Guild of America. Were you present at the time it was presented to him?
Yeah, I was at that ceremony, sure.
Did you get a chance to ever speak with him directly?
Yeah, I interviewed him 3 times. I had my first meeting with him was 1975. He had come back from Russia, where he made The Bluebird, which was a disastrous fiasco. And he and I had a good time having lunch. And he was a very resilient man. He rolled with the punches. He always, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, start all over again. That's kind of his motto. And I asked him at one point. I said, "What is it like to be fired from a film?" I was thinking of a film called Desire Me, from which he had been removed. And he leaned over to his publicist. He put his hand on my forearm, and he said, "Notice with what finesse he avoids mentioning the title 'Gone with the Wind,'" which I thought was such a witty thing to say. He was notoriously fired from Gone with the Wind by David O. Selznick, and it was a blow to his pride, but he rolled with the punches and went off and made The Women, which is one of his best films, and then he
Well,
made.
he also worked with one of the actresses in Gone with the Wind unofficially after he was fired, wasn't
Oh
he?
yes, yeah, he Vivien Leigh and Olivia de Havilland were so upset that he was fired that they would come to his house on weekends surreptitiously to get directed by him. And so he continued directing the performances behind the back of Victor Fleming, the
A
official
great,
director.
that's a great
Yeah.
story. I want to quote from your introduction, a part of your introduction in the book. Your introduction is a book in itself. It's many, many pages. I'm not used to a long introduction, but I enjoyed it immensely. But let me quote. It says, his style, the Cukor style, knowledge of the world, elegance of style, distinctions of subjects chosen, distinction of actors, refinement of cutting, a world in which everyone is in half tones, suggested and never overstressed. That's not your quote. So you were quoting someone else that talked about him. Do you feel that's a good description of George
Yeah,
Cukor?
that's a wonderful description by Henri Langlois, who is the head of the Cinémathèque Française, a great figure in world cinema. Very eloquent, but frustratingly short. And Cukor did an interview book with Gavin Lambert, who became a friend of mine, and it's a marvelous interview book called On Cukor. And that's a bit frustrating too, because Cukor is wonderfully witty and informative, but he kind of doesn't go all the way to describe everything you'd like to read about. That's the job of a critic, not the artist himself. And also the other thing about Cukor that makes him elusive is that he was a closeted queer filmmaker. He preferred the term queer to gay. He was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And so he was not self-promoting like a lot of directors. He didn't court profiles and interviews as much as a lot of other people did, although he was accessible. And I also did a long interview with him with Todd McCarthy about his late work around the time of Rich and Famous, which was his last feature. And I was on the set of that film. And so he was a wonderful guy to interview. And he was a very profane, very bawdy guy too. And Gavin Lambert took exception to the fact that we quoted Cukor accurately, saying kind of a lot of racy stuff. And he said,
Right.
I took that out of my book. And I said, well, that's the way he talked. He's a funny guy, and he was a Rabelaisian figure. And in his work, he dealt with what we now call gender fluidity, the people's gender. The locus classicus in his work is Sylvia Scarlett with Katharine Hepburn. And if people haven't seen that, I'd recommend that as a great starting place. It'll knock people out. She plays a boy through most of the film. She's in disguise. And she's a very good looking boy, very charming. And both men and women are attracted to her. This is 1935 film. And then she becomes a girl again because she's flirting with a guy, and she's a very pretty girl, and she's at the height of her beauty in this film. But it's a very witty film about sort of blurring the boundaries between masculinity and femininity and questioning what do these mean. These are We now realize that gender is kind of a performance, and Cukor was really into that because a lot of his work deals with performing people, either actors or lawyers like Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy and Adam Zrib, or singers, or people in the public eye, or just Travels with My Aunt with Maggie Smith. She's this bigger than life flamboyant woman who puts on a show and does she's fooling people. She's a con woman, and she's in disguise sometimes, and so he loved the whole performing aspect, and that makes him very modern, very ahead of his time.
Sure, and that was from the 30s. He also, even though he was closeted, he was not in the sense of within the industry, within his friends. He was not closeted. So he just kept a low profile, like in terms of the general public. Would that be a
Yeah,
fair
everybody in Hollywood, it
assumption?
was an open secret. He didn't hide it or deny it. He didn't pretend like, male stars who are gay often have to pretend that they're straight, have marriages or fake romances or whatever. Cukor didn't go in for that. He would escort ladies to premieres and things like that, and he had great parties with all kinds of people. So he had friends throughout the whole industry, and they all accepted him. Hollywood is very accepting toward gay people, but it was not talked about much. And he actually didn't like gay people who were too flamboyant, like James Whale, the director. He felt that Whale's career suffered from being too open, and he felt that it hurt the cause. Also, I mean, but he
Well,
grew up in it.
what was it open or performative in that sense? Because you can be obviously a homosexual and not necessarily be effeminate.
Yeah, well, Whale, he lived with a man very openly, a producer, and they were a couple, and they went around together, and that's something Cukor didn't do. He had a double life. That's my friend Pat McGilligan's title for his Cukor biography, which is very thorough. And Cukor, he had these A-list parties for, big people in Hollywood. And he had friends from the literary world. And then he had, on Sundays, he'd have his gay friends over to his house. And those were people who were not necessarily well known. Some of them were, but a lot of them were just pals of his. But it was a stratified kind of environment there. He lived that double life, and they didn't. He just was he kept a careful line in his behavior, and that's he felt that it was necessary in his time. He gave an interview toward the end of his life to The Advocate, which is a gay newspaper, and he more or less came out of the closet. He didn't quite say I'm queer, but he more or less said that, and he discussed what it was like. And the two interviewers said, "What will it take for gay people to be more visible and films and society and more accepted?" And he said, "Time." And he said, 20, 25 years from now, it'll be better. I won't be around. This is 40 years ago." And but he and they said, "What can gay people do to advance the cause?" And he says, "Behave themselves." And he just the interviewers were a bit taken aback. He wasn't blaming gay people. He just felt they had to be discreet. That was a word that he used a lot,
Right.
discretion. And that his work fulfills that, because he deals with the margins and the boundaries of behavior. And E.M. Forster was a great novelist who was gay, who excelled in creating portraits of both men and women and marriages. Cukor, being an outsider, since he was not only gay, he was Jewish and the son of Hungarian immigrants, he was kind of sort of an insider and outsider simultaneously, which helped him as an observer. He could really understand the dynamics of heterosexual marriage, and but he had a lot of characters who were kind of fringe characters in life too. But there were certain limits in Hollywood. You couldn't, he experimented with some characters who were kind of more openly gay, and he sort of got slapped down by the code. You can't do this and you can't do that. So he had to be very subtle. And the subtlety actually helped his art, I believe.
I think subtlety always helps art in a lot of ways, especially when you're under the production code in those days and you had to do it in a subtle way. There was more art to it, there's more finesse to it, and it makes more of an impact than if you're blatant about something, whatever it is.
Yeah, I did a book on Billy Wilder, who was known for pushing the envelope. And Cooper pushed the envelope in his own ways, but Wilder did it kind of more brazenly and got more controversy stirred up for what he did. But he said that the code was actually a spur to creativity for the very reason you mentioned, that people had to be clever and subtle to get around certain obvious restrictions, but it did limit subject matter to some extent. But in his later work, Cukor dealt it more with outre sexuality in Travels with My Aunt and Justine and Rich and Famous. Rich and Famous caused some controversy because Jacqueline Bisset plays an unmarried woman novelist who picks up guys for one night stands, and Cukor is very open about that, and he has some rather erotic scenes. And Pauline Kael wrote a kind of homophobic review of the film and said this is the kind of film that a gay person would make. But she said it in a very negative, sneering way. And my friend Stuart Byron, who is an openly gay critic on the Village Voice, wrote a rebuttal and attacked her for this homophobia. But that hurt Cukor's feelings. But he was pushing the envelope as far as he could in that film. That's
Did
his
she
final film, you know.
did Pauline ever change her attitudes or mind about anything she wrote in all the years she did film reviews, to your
Well,
knowledge?
she took pride in not seeing a film twice, which I think is very strange because I don't write about a film until I've seen it several times at least. And with Cukor films, I saw them over and over and over, and you really penetrate more deeply into things. But yeah, she didn't change her positions, you know, like her infamous attack on Orson Welles, claiming he didn't write any of Citizen Kane. It was all Herman Mankiewicz. It's really not true. They really collaborated. She was proven wrong by me and Robert Carringer and Andrew Saras and other people, but she shamelessly reprinted that piece in her big collection. She sort of had this ego about not backing down once she had taken a position on something.
It's too bad. It'd be nice to see writers or reviewers evolve in a sense that we're at least be able to admit a mistake or an error or perhaps a different perception, seeing
Yeah,
it
you
from
really
another
should, and
lens.
people respect that if you say, well, you know, I misunderstood this scene or I got this fact wrong. I always do that if I updated John Ford, which is a critical study, Mike Wilmington. I did Mike died a few years ago, and I did a new
Yeah,
edition.
you're on my show talking about John Ford. I can't keep up with the number of books you've written. It's amazing to me how you can write these books in great depth and yet produce so many over a period of time.
Well, thank you. I think I'm very concentrated. I've been writing books nonstop since 1963. When I was 15, I wrote a book about baseball when I was a teenager. And, you know, some of these books take years to do and,
Yeah, exactly.
many years to contemplate too. But, you know, once I set down, set myself in motion to do it, I'm very disciplined. And part of the trick is just write every day. I tell people, like, people say, how do you get around writer's block? Right. I say, write every day. It's like W.C. Fields was asked, how do you deal with insomnia? And he said, get plenty of sleep. You know, it's pretty simple, actually. If you write every day, if you write a couple pages per day, you'll have a big book by the end of the year, and
Yeah,
then you
you're
can.
right. It may not be the best book, but it's done, and then you can rewrite it and edit it. And yeah, that's good advice for people. I hope there are people who are watching and listening take that advice, who want to be good writers and prolific writers, which is almost as important as a good writer. And when I was going to ask you when you were talking about that you had met George Cukor a couple of times, I was going to ask you whether he offered you a job in a movie, since that's the
Oh.
famous Orson Welles story with you. So that's why I didn't.
No, but I think I was directed by him by proxy. This is interesting. I actually, Wells did put me in The Other Side of the Wind, and I spent 5 years acting for him, and he was one of the very greatest actors, directors in film, just like Cukor and Ingmar Bergman and a few others. But I learned so much from working with a great director, even though as a non-actor, he liked working with a mixture of people, from great actors to non-actors, and I saw him handling a very disparate cast of people, and each person, a great director handles every person differently, and a mediocre director treats everybody the same, and Cukor, Wells were master psychologists, but I was directed by Cukor by proxy. I'm in a Merchant Ivory film called The Wild Party, which is sort of loosely based on the Fatty Arbuckle scandal party. And it was made in 1975 in Riverside, California. I was a newspaper reporter, and I talked my way into the film. And it takes place at a big Hollywood party in the late 20s. And so I was a party goer, and the Merchant Ivory told me that when they were preparing the film, they went to George Cukor because he had been around back then, and they said, how do we stage a Hollywood party circa 1929? And he said, well, tell your assistant director to go around and talk to each party goer, each extra, and give the person a backstory. Tell them who they are, why they're at the party, what their, goals are, et cetera. So during the shooting of a scene when James Coco, the star, enters this party, the AD came over to me and said, you're the son of a studio chief and you're on the make at this party because you want to be a producer. And so you're trying to make an impression. So when Coco walked past me, I grabbed his hand and he kind of was startled, but he went with it, Yeah. So then later I asked Cukor, I said, did you talk to Merchant and Ivory about this? He said, oh yeah. And he told me exactly what he had told him. And so I feel I was kind of directed by George Cukor by
I like
proxy. But
that.
that's a sample of how he would. Every actor is important. Frank Capra used to say that. I treat everybody, smallest part, as a star. Everybody is important in a film.
Well, Cukor was very wise in the sense that he, as you talked about, he worked with the actors. Some directors are a little bit more generic, but he worked with the individual actors and approached them in their own way so he could get the best performance. And you said earlier he had the fidelity to the written word. That didn't stop him from occasionally having writers come in to rewrite to make sure it was perfect for whatever adaptation he was doing. But if I had to force you to name the top three Cukor films from your perspective as a reviewer, as a writer, author, film guy, professor, what would those top three be?
Well, I think to me, there's no doubt his greatest film is A Star Is Born with Judy Garland and James Mason. It's one of the maybe 20 best films ever made. A deeply moving study of human nature. These people are so profound. It was butchered to some extent by the studio, but my friend Ron Haver partly restored it. That's a really great film. I would put up Sylvia Scarlett really high. There's so many good ones. I mean, one that means a lot to me is My Fair Lady, and it's kind of smug for a lot of cinephiles to put down My Fair Lady as saying, oh, it's based on this packaged play, big Broadway hit, et cetera, based on Pygmalion by Shaw. And Cukor was just, the ringmaster or whatever. But that film, I think, is a great film, and it deals with his theme of a person being transformed and becoming almost a different person, and the question of identity and the question of masculinity and femininity. A great performance by Rex Harrison and Audrey Hepburn. Maybe not perfect for the part, but she's very moving in a lot of ways. And it means a lot to me because when I was a teenager, I had a physical and mental breakdown in high school, and because I was in a repressed Catholic school. And they would let me out of the. I was in the hospital. I went into a mental hospital for 4 months, which was actually the best experience I ever had in my life, because it changed me into a different person. But on weekends, I would get passes, and I started going to see My Fair Lady, and I saw it 5 times at a big theater downtown in Milwaukee. This was the day that these were the days when they had the road shows, where a film would play for months with a hard ticket and beautiful big screen, wonderful sound, big theater downtown. And this film overwhelmed me. I just identified totally with Eliza Doolittle. I was being changed. I was in love with this young woman who was very disturbed, but she was a wonderful person, and she brought out my personality, made me a better person. I also could identify with Henry Higgins because I was into etymology. It was kind of my hobby in high school. I wrote my first book, which I was writing at the time, was on baseball slang. So I was kind of a pedantic philologist, like Henry Higgins. So I could relate to both characters, which is what Cukor did too. Cukor could relate to both people. So that film changed my life and helped me survive. And so I feel very personally connected. And over the years, I just have studied that film a lot. And I wrote quite a long essay in that film about the two main performances. And I think it holds up really well. It's one of his best films, but he made so many other great films. Pat and Mike is wonderful. There are some films that people don't think about very much. Like there's one called The Model and the Marriage Broker, which stars Thelma Ritter. How many times do you see a movie starring the great Thelma Ritter? She was probably the greatest character actress.
Yes,
But she
indeed.
got to be the leading character in this wonderful movie by Cukor, a very modest film. Modesty was one of his virtues. It's beautifully written film. And when you ask about the writing, he would work with the writers. Katharine Hepburn said Little Women, which was one of Cukor's best films and one of her favorites. I think it was her favorite film. She said she wouldn't commit to it until they had a really good script. And Herman and Mason, a married couple, wrote the script. They got an Oscar for it, and Cukor worked with them. And also on the Ruth Gordon, Garson Kanin scripts, Cukor would, work with them very intensively in the development of the scripts and, draft after draft. And he respected them so much that when they were back home in Connecticut and he was shooting the film, he would, if he wanted to change a line or if an actor wanted to add a line or something, he would call them on the phone and stop everything until, or he would say, "Could we need a couple of lines here for such and such?" And, they'd call back in half an hour and give him the lines. And that's very rare, but more directors should do that. It's very smart.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. Our guest has been Joseph McBride. He's author of George Cukor's People, Acting for a Master Director. It's published by Columbia University Press. It's available as an ebook right now on Amazon, very soon, the print edition. And Joe, thanks for again for being on the show.
Thank you, Ira. It's always a delight, and I look forward to the next time. It's terrific to
Absolutely.
talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.